Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
So delighted to be joined the line by Scotland centre, Graham Morrison. Graham, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Surviving and thriving through the lockdown period. Glad there's no camera on because it's been a pretty hot day up in Glasgow and I've got a bit of burn to the forehead. So yeah, I'm doing well as can be, and yeah, it's good to be on with you guys.
Nice one. So is that you based back in Glasgow now? Then sort of have you sort of settled down there?
I lived in the west end of Glasgow up until 2 years ago. I was working for the Royal Bank of Scotland in Edinburgh and moved jobs to the city centre of Glasgow. But then my family started to expand. I've got three very young children, The oldest being 5. And so we decided to move out so that we could have a garden and have somewhere other than a couple of flights of stairs up. And my wife was having to battle 3 kids up every day. So just on the outskirts of Glasgow, a place called Uddingston. But yeah. I guess that's where I'm working from at the moment, because that's what we've been doing for the past 5 months.
Yeah, definitely. And for the people who don't know, what is your sort of career post rugby these days? What fills your time?
I'm a chartered accountant with a firm called Johnston Carmichael, who are, you know, they're one of the largest firm of CAs in Scotland. Yeah, it was a slightly different career path or trajectory than one that I was on a few years ago playing rugby, but I guess the things kind of work in mysterious ways, and I've put myself through that CA qualification and thoroughly enjoying what I do now, working in corporate finance.
Nice one. And how much do you miss that day-to-day rugby, or is it kind of, you know, far enough behind you now that that's just, you know, this different stage of your life that what you're doing right now?
There's not a day goes by that I don't miss it, but it's missing different aspects of it than playing rugby, to be honest. When I finished, I'd had several operations on my knees. My fingers are very, very close to having arthritis. My nose was, broken several times. And so that aspect of that I don't really miss. Having said that, when I hung the boots up, that was what I missed. I just loved being out there and kind of keeping fit, playing with the boys and, going into battle on Friday night, because that's what it's all about. But as time goes on and sort of the hair gets a bit greyer, or the beard hair, because I've got none on top, it kind of it's missing other aspects of it. And the thing is, I miss the team.
Sure.
I miss the boys. I miss the kind of camaraderie and the requirement to have incredibly thick skin, the change room stuff that you don't really get in the corporate world.
Yeah.
Because if you did, you'd probably be in front of HR every other day. So it's that element of it. And I guess the other things that come with it are, the kind of discipline and real desire to be successful, and the kind of responsibility that you and your peers have to drive those standards to each other as well, and accountability. So yeah, I miss all that stuff. But you know, as I said, I don't miss having to limp to the bathroom at 4 a.m. because I can't walk after a tough game.
Yeah, have you been tempted by any kind of like club rugby or anything? I see that, you know, Glasgow Accies seem to have a new ex Glasgow player every 6 months. I see they've just signed Rua Jackson as well as player coach.
I have to check the salary cap on that one.
Yeah.
I think given the nature of my retirement, and it was through being, you know, pretty badly injured in the knee, my last season, you know, it was a case of kind of playing a match, and if it was a really physical match, it'd probably be a couple of weeks before I could fully straighten my right leg. And then I'd sort of get back for fit and playing and play another match, and it would be another couple of weeks. It just wasn't sustainable. To throw the boots back on for the odd game would love to do it, but it's just, I don't think it's possible, but it's also just not worth it, to be honest. If I took another knock, then I wouldn't be able to run around my kids, I don't think.
Well, so the bright lights of kind of Glasgow Accies against West of Scotland just doesn't quite do it for you.
Well, do you know what? If they had a kind of reserve list and I found myself on it, then I could live with that. good to be thought about, but yeah, at the moment I'll pass.
Yeah.
If they move rugby this summer, then potentially. But at the moment, I'm quite happy to watch from the sidelines.
And what about coaching? Do you sort of, you know, keep your hand in with that? Did that ever interest you?
It did, and you know, there were kind of a couple of options that I had. One of which was to go back to Hong Kong, which is where I was born and brought up. My parents still live in Hong Kong, and to get involved with Hong Kong rugby and coaching, and I could probably find a job there with union or doing a kind of, you know, sports related business development type role.
Yeah,
but I kind of, you know, by the end of my 10th season with Glasgow, and all the injuries and all the kind of highs and lows and, you know, selection woes, and I just wanted to take a step back from the game and fall in love with it again as a kind of spectator. You know, I do love rugby and I've never kind of stopped, but it was just, I just need a bit of a break from it. And then the kind of realization that when you actually look at, you know, particularly Scottish coaches, only a handful of them will kind of make it to the top.
Yeah.
And I was literally starting out a new family. I thought, you know, I need to build another career here. And I think if I go into coaching, I'll probably be prolonging the inevitable for myself. You know, a couple of years down the line, if I didn't kind of make it or break through, then I'd be in the exact same position. Whereas if I get some tools, develop some other skills for later life now, I can always go back to coaching at some point in the future.
Yeah.
But it'll be a lot harder to hit the books when, you know, you're kind of 40, 45 than it was when I retired 7 years ago. So, yeah, maybe when my two young sons are kind of hitting it up through the minis.
Yeah.
I may dip my hand, but at the moment, just focused on developing my new career and trying to get as successful as I can in that area first.
Yeah, of course. I mean, going back to your old career, your first career, as it were, your rugby career. Maybe we could just sort of take you back right to the start, and just what sort of your earliest memories are of picking up a rugby ball, involvement in a club, that kind of thing. What were those sort of earliest memories?
Well, I think, you know, growing up in Hong Kong, rugby wasn't you know, as popular as it is over in Scotland, and there wasn't a huge amount of opportunity, or the same amount of opportunity as there was in Scotland. So, but having said that, I certainly remember the Sevens coming to town every year, and as a young boy going along to that and seeing guys like Serevi, even that's where Lomu kind of burst onto the scene, guys like that, and that just definitely, you know, kind of pricked up the attention. My dad had played a bit of rugby in Hong Kong, and he'd represented Scotland B, so I knew that I had a bit of a pedigree. But it was really getting sent to boarding school. I got sent across the boarding school to Dollar Academy at quite an early age, and the boarding house I was in, the boarding house master was a guy called John Foster, who was the coach of the first, you know, time. So I had 8 years in the boarding house with him. He also coached Harriers for a time while I was at school. So he was with me 24/7. I'd kind of, you know, the fire started to get stoked, and he would definitely, you know, kind of keep my interest going. and I became really close to him, almost like a, you know, kind of father figure. And
right.
He definitely kind of kept that sort of desire going and just wanted the best for me. And the fact that I was in his boarding house, kind of, I think made him quite proud when, you know, when I started to make it big. And so yeah, that my earliest memories are just really kind of the lessons that he taught me, the culture that he kind of gave me from an early age. And yeah, he unfortunately passed away a few years ago with kind of an MND related illness. So you know, hugely indebted to him. But yeah, my earliest memories are just the kind of long chats and the sessions that we used to have at school with him. And you know, that they were essentially the things that got me to where I got to.
Yeah, for sure. And when did you sort of start to think, you know, I'm not too bad at this. This could be a potential career path.
We had a pretty successful school side when I was at school, and you know, we didn't lose many games. We maybe lost a handful in the kind of 8 year period that we played together as a year group. And it was kind of when I hit fourth, fifth year where I started getting noticed by the age group selectors. But also, just you know, actually one day, Jim Telfer and Ian McGeeson came to Dollar to speak to a few of the guys, myself included, just to find out what our plans were for the future. And at that point, I was like, oh, shit, you know, we could be on here. And then I played 21s while I was still at school.
Really?
In Shortland, yeah. I went on a mini tour down to England with 21s, and I was blown away because I was...
Jeez.
Yeah, I was pretty young on that tour, but it gave me a taste for it. Sean Lanin was the backs coach at the time, and again, we were kind of, I guess, similar personalities. He played centre as well, so I guess he saw me as a bit of a project, and told me that if I kind of stuck at it, then you know I'd be able to go far. And you know, I was fortunate that he was my 21s coach for a couple of seasons, and then became the backs coach at Glasgow. And when I saw that he'd signed, I thought there was a good chance that that he may give me an opportunity if I kept my head down. And thankfully, he did. Thankfully, he did. Now, when I say I kept my head down, I still had that sort of period of leaving school and going to uni and finding out what the nightlife outside the Dollar was like, which was pretty detrimental to both my career prospects and my kind of body fat percentage. So he definitely cracked the whip a little bit when he did sign me, because I had a lot to owe him. But that was the start, and he was my coach at Glasgow for several years, and again, hugely indebted to Sean for that.
Was there an academy set up at that time that you were like assigned to?
There wasn't, actually, no. So I kind of finished school. I played for the Hawks for you know, a couple of seasons, mm-hmm. And then he gave me the opportunity, and there wasn't really a kind of setup. And I was just told, you know, bide your time. And I remember meeting the club doctor, Jerry Haggerty, and he's like, you know, from my first medical, and he said, don't get disheartened. You know, your first year pro, you're very young. You'll probably not play much this season. I think I played, you know, all but a handful of games that year. And then got my first cap for Scotland. So it was a huge learning curve. I definitely remember being very uncomfortable with trying to get my head around the multi-phase approach and the systems, and particularly in defence, it was like a foreign language. You know, you go from club rugby into pro rugby, and it's a proper step up with the various systems and calls. But that was something that, you know, since from a very early age, I wanted to do, and it was a dream come true to be able to do that.
What? Who was your Glasgow debut against? Do you remember much of that match?
It was a pre-season friendly against Newcastle Falcons.
Right.
And it was that Hughenden in Glasgow, beautiful weather. I just remember not being able to eat for a couple of days before. I was so nervous.
Yeah.
My opposite man, I believe, was a former All Black, which I can't remember his name. His first name was Mark, but... I guess he was coming to the end of his career, and I was kicking off. So yeah,
was that Mapletoft?
That was it.
Yeah.
So I was pretty nervous, but did reasonably well. Played reasonably well, and then the second game was away the following week to Gloucester, and I was on the bench for that one, and I came off the bench and scored a try. So the first two games were pretty good, pretty positive for me, and then we just cracked on from there.
Who were the sort of big characters that you were in the team that you were coming into at that point?
We had, so there's quite a few of the old school players. Glenn Metcalf was one that stands out for me. He was a superstar for Scotland. And then you kind of go into the team environment with him and just couldn't believe it because he was someone I'd watched, as a schoolboy. And then actually he's kind of standing right next to him in a huddle. And he's kind of inspiring you was huge. But a really, really good guy off the pitch. He was part of the old school and he was all about hierarchy as well. So, you know, if we played an away game, he would be like, right, you're going around the team room and you're getting coffees for everyone. Mm-hmm. And that was fine because, you know, when you're able to let your hair down and enjoy it, he was always the first to make sure you were well looked after. So he was definitely a good inspiration. But then guys like Gordie Bullock, Cammy Mather was the captain at the time, mm. Johnny Petrie was in the team. And then you've got your Donny McFadyens, the kind of great beverages, all the guys that played for Scotland, which was just a huge thing to be part of. And, you know, playing in the centre with Andy Henderson as well, just a pretty long list of fairly household Scottish rugby playing names that I was very fortunate to be part of.
Yeah, definitely. Did you kind of have that, a bit of the crossover with the kind of semi-pro side of things as well? Like how much did that change in all the time that you spent at Glasgow? Was it still a very professional environment at that time?
I would say not. we definitely didn't conduct ourselves in the manner when I started at Glasgow to when I finished at Glasgow. We had, it was fully professional. I mean, rugby had been professional for a few years at that point, but I guess there was the mentality. Some of the guys that had played in both years and had gone from amateurs into the pro ranks, and when it had been kind of less as professional. And so, there were the odd midweek sesh, and you'd hear tales of boys kind of going out potentially even before games. But that kind of got weeded out pretty quickly when the coaching staff kind of caught wind of. Maybe not caught wind, but when we just weren't performing, when we were losing, when we were finishing bottom of the table, we kind of had something had to change, and the coaching staff did kind of get rid of quite a lot of that mentality, and unfortunately that meant some players had to go because they were driving those behavioural issues. But it's a business, and it's about like being as good as you can be, and stealing a living as a professional rugby player ahead of someone who would give an arm to be there is something we soon realised that we were actually doing and needed to buckle up or we'd probably find ourselves in a different profession sooner than our time. So, yeah, I'd say first couple of years was, a huge honour to be there, but were we doing everything we could possibly do as a group of people? No. Pleased to say that the Glasgow kind of started at that point and just got better and better because the culture improved so much over the years.
And who was sort of the main driver of that cultural shift? Because as you say, it is amazing, the progress that Glasgow made from sort of scrambling around the bottom of the table to competing at the top.
Yeah, I'd say kind of first and foremost, Sean Lineen probably had a big say on that. When I first joined Glasgow, we did get given a kind of set of core values, which really didn't mean too much to us. They kind of handed to us, and we were expected to kind of live them. Mm-hmm. And Sean actually placed a lot of emphasis on really kind of bringing the team together, and really kind of becoming a much tighter unit, but also behaving ourselves and conducting ourselves in the manner that we should do. And he was very big on kind of pre-season weekends away and a lot of team building stuff, pretty cringeworthy stuff, like we'd be put into groups and we'd have to, over the course of kind of a weekend away, come up with a play and perform it in front of the other lads, which was usually embarrassing, but incredibly useful tool in terms of building team spirit and team culture. Mm. But it was also the sessions with Sean to come up with what the culture should look like and what the values should be. And when you start to sort of, come up with them yourselves and feel connected to them, they automatically become more powerful and you kind of automatically want to live them a bit more. Mm. So I'd say he was a hugely influential in that. He also was very good at, I guess, targeting younger players that he believed had a good future. Mm-hmm. And just back in the day where, you know, it's probably no secret that Edinburgh were the team. You know, they were more successful. You know, as a player, as a Glasgow player, you probably thought that they had a bigger budget and that a lot more funds got funneled towards Edinburgh.
Yeah.
They got the players like Todd Blackadder, the Brendan Laneys. And I think with a perceived smaller budget, Sean was very good at identifying younger players that he thought would grow and would get better. And you look at players like, you know, Sean Lamont, you know, to an extent myself, who stayed with the team, the Evans brothers, even Pete Horn, guys like that. But then it was actually Sean who brought Al across from Edinburgh to Glasgow and made him captain. And Al Kellogg was, again, probably a hugely, definitely a hugely influential person and reason that the culture of Glasgow improved, because, you know, even if you speak to him now, that's what it's all about for him. It's all about, you know, that excellence and that discipline and a huge culture. And because we had this group of players, this young group of players, and Al coming as captain, that we were going to be the sort of backbone of the team for several years, we all just kind of grew together in that regard. And we all became senior players, and we'd grown up together and wanted to do that. And as a result of that, it became a really powerful tool.
It's really interesting that the sort of point you bring up about Edinburgh was that when you were going into the sort of the Scottish rival matches, was that like a motivating factor? Did you kind of see yourselves as underdogs? And did, like, you know, do those matches have that kind of more of an edge than other matches in the Pro 14? Or is it a bit odd that you're maybe playing against like Scotland teammates, for instance?
Yeah. So I guess the first kind of caveat is that's how it was perceived. I can definitely say that we had a bigger budget, but the players they had, like, you know, Chris Parsons, now of course he kind of grown up as an Edinburgh player. But when Todd Blackadder went there, when Brendan Laney went there, they had a great team, and you know potentially they built that internally themselves. But yeah, of course, playing in those 1872 Cup games were huge. Players now will probably tell you, "Oh, you know, it's just not a game." But I can tell you right now, it's not. Like, it is a derby match, and in any sport, a derby match is a big match. Mm. And so, playing against your mates in the national squad, it doesn't really matter. You know, rugby's a game where you are as attritional as you possibly can be on the pitch, regardless of who you're playing against, and probably even more so if you know that person, because, you know, that physical dominance and that one-upmanship is huge. It's all about the competition, and it's being able to then, you know, have a couple of beers afterwards and then put your arm around them and get back on with them. But hugely motivating. And, you know, they were the unofficial trial. And if you played a couple of good 1872 Cup games and really stood out, then the small pool of players we have in Scotland, you were definitely going to put your hand up for international honours at some point.
You mentioned earlier, obviously, that international debut. I mean, obviously, it came about really quickly. When did you sort of find out that you were on the radar of the coaches at the time? What was it? Matt Williams was coach at the time.
It was. Yeah. So Matt put together his first squad, which was quite a big squad, for a training camp in Stirling, and I was included in it. And again, a lot of the younger players, like the Sean Lamonts, the Hugo Southwells, all these guys that were kind of like relatively unheard of, but had just come into the Scottish game. And Matt was my first international coach, right? So again, a huge amount of respect and gratitude for him picking me and giving me the opportunity.
Yeah.
But it was it was at that point I thought we could be in line here for selection. There's a tour to Australia in this season. He's obviously building to that. It'd be great to be involved in that. And my first couple of involvements in the national camp, they were just training camps, pretty much bag holding. I didn't expect any more than that, but it was just great to be part of that, to be with players like the aforementioned guys instead of Glasgow. But then you've got your kind of Jason those kind of guys, real household names in Scottish rugby. And then, you know, I got selected for that tour to Australia, which was my first taste of, okay, selection here we go. And it was a 5-week tour to Australia. It was a hugely important thing for me to be involved in that. And it was a great achievement.
What are your memories of Matt Williams as a coach? Obviously, he sort of like gets quite a lot of stick, and it's probably a period of Scottish rugby history that most fans like to forget. Yeah, yeah. But you know, it can't have been all bad.
He's done good things. He did good things with Ireland, and he did, you know, he's did well with Leinster. You know, he was, again, my first international coach. I didn't know what to expect.
Yeah.
But, I guess some of the senior players and he didn't really see eye to eye. Looking back, it was very prescriptive rugby. I think that he inherited a Scotland team that were underperforming, and he realised that, and he tried to strip it right back to the basics, like right back to the basics. So, you know, the first 10 minutes of a training session would be literally standing static, facing down the pitch and doing pendulum swing passes to each other because we weren't very good at passing, or so he led us to believe. So that's what it was. It was really getting the basics, trying to get the basics nailed on. And I think some of the more seasoned pros were like, what is going on here? Like, let's just go and play rugby and let's play some heads up rugby. But I think that Matt's kind of ideas were that you really had to sort of build strong basic skills, which is what any coach will do, and any coach will tell you. I mean, the All Blacks, their basics are absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah.
But I think potentially too much emphasis was placed on the fact that we weren't very good at the basics, rather than, you know, just making them excellent. Listen, I'm hugely grateful that he gave me my first cap. But you know, potentially the shackles that he put on the team, because he wanted us to do things his way in order to succeed. We're probably holding some of that playing group back.
Yeah. And what are your memories that remain from that first cap? Were you sort of equally as nervous as before your first Glasgow cap, or was it sort of maybe a different level?
I was terrified. Yeah, because it was again a huge honour. I didn't expect to be named in the test side. We kind of had, it was almost like a Clive Woodward Lion setup. We had literally a midweek team flew out to Australia early, and the kind of international team played the Babas at Murrayfield and flew out potentially a week later.
Right. Wow.
So we were out there training separately, in a separate hotel initially, and then we joined together. We were very much knew that we were the kind of second string team.
Yeah.
I think it was my first game out there was against the Queensland Reds, and I think I missed 7 tackles potentially. but the pace of the game.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
On Australian ground, the crowd, I'd never experienced it, and I was absolutely shocked. I think it was Drew Mitchell's debut.
Oh, really?
And so, you know, he's gone on to be one of the great players. I remember him being a great player that day.
Mm.
And I thought to myself, you know, I've absolutely stuffed my chances of any kind of test match on this after that. And we went through the video debrief, and I got sort of called out for, you know, my sloppy defence. And the second game was then against the Waratahs, and I played against Nathan Gray, was my awesome man.
Mm.
And I had a happy game of my life. Like, it was one of my best games to date in the jersey, and the coaches were very complimentary afterwards. And then, you know, a few days later, I was named on the bench to start to play against Australia. Which, you know, when I think when that team got read out, I started to feel a bit faint in the room, just because of the magnitude and the huge honour that it was. But
yeah,
I can't really remember too much of the game other than I came on for about 9 minutes, collapsed them all, gave a penalty away, and you know, we were losing by about 30 points anyway. So, but it was good to be on there.
Sure. Was there a kind of initiation or anything that you had to do afterwards from the time?
Well, it was a short turnaround. So I think it was a 6-day turnaround. So we got told, right, boys, under no circumstances are you going out tonight.
Right.
And so that's not to say we didn't, because I was trying to remember sort of going to the hotel bar just to, you know, maybe have a pint. You could have a couple in the hotel, but I remember then sort of having a beer and just started to leave to my room, and a couple of the boys were like, where are you going? I was like, oh, I'm just going to my room. And he's like, no, you're not. You've got your first cap. We're going out. I'll not name names, but a couple of the older boys took me out, and we definitely did go out that night. And albeit a short turnaround, we struggled through the week and played again on the weekend. So it was a good old time. But I guess that was still of that era where some players would do that.
Yeah.
And nowadays that's completely gone, and for the better. it's all about performance recovery.
Yeah, sure. When you sort of came back from that tour, did that kind of really like focus your attention on, you know, I want to be starting for Scotland, like, you know, I want to get better and better? Did, you know, was that a sort of change in mindset that you went through?
It was, and I tasted international rugby in my first season. You know, I was kind of 21 years old, and I was like, you know, this is what I want to be doing. I did say to you that, you know, my year at uni was probably a bit too social for a good springboard into professional rugby, and I was pretty unfit and pretty kind of unhealthy, and it was all about the education of that side of things. You know, I never sort of had to keep a food diary or speak to a nutritionist before, and so it was, you know, probably eating things that I didn't realise were actually that bad for me. And you know, I know the drinking's not good for you, but temptation as a young student where all my mates were going out was too much. But I played my first six caps, four of which were against Australia, so real tough games.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, my performances probably weren't consistently good enough, and I got dropped from the national team after that, and spent close to 4 years in the wilderness, you know, just kind of getting my game up to speed with Glasgow, getting a lot fitter, getting a lot more mature, you know, kind of more game savvy and clever. And then after that, you know, I put in several good performances in the Glasgow shirt, and yes, you know, Frank Haddon gave me the next chance, and I stayed in the team or thereabouts for the next few years until I had to retire. So looking back, you know, I wished I'd probably gone into professional rugby in you know, a better mindset, a better state, and kind of knew more what it was about. But you know, I kind of went from the amateur era into professional rugby with no academy set up, and it was a very steep learning curve.
Yeah.
And some players adapted to that really well, and I just took a little bit longer. But I think that being out of the national team for that period of time and then going back into it, I was so hungry to be there, to stay there. Mm. But I also learned a lot, and I felt I was probably more ready.
Yeah. And over that period, from when you got back into the Scotland setup, you know, who are the coaches that you sort of, you know, got on best with and kind of fitted your philosophy and, you know, style of play, that sort of thing? Who did you like working with?
Yeah, well, Frank was the coach, and everyone knows Frank liked to play a wide game.
Yeah.
Frank liked to play the ball wide. His Edinburgh back line that he'd had when he was there, they were very good at just getting the ball out there. And that worked for a period of time, but then, you know, if you just pepper the ball wide, it's quite easy to defend against. Defenses can read you and learn that you're going to play and how you're going to play, and they can just kind of you know, soak up your yardage and start beating you with their defence. So Frank wasn't the national coach for a huge amount of time that I was there. I really liked the style of play. It was attractive. It was good to watch. It was exciting to be part of. But it just wasn't winning us. It was too many games. But
yeah.
You know, in that time, Sean Lennon was involved in the backs coaching, so I had him as a good sort of friendly kind of mentor, go to guy when I was there. Alan Tate was the defence coach, and huge respect from him as a player and as a coach. So it was again huge to be involved with good quality coaches of that nature. And then I guess Gregor got involved in the setup when Andy Robinson took over, which was the next coach. And you know, he's just a class operator. So there's always been someone that I've kind of really looked up to and really admired and learned a lot from when I've been in the national setup, and that's been good.
Was it ever kind of frustrating that when you were lining up in the centre, you were probably playing a Scotland team that was a bit more forward orientated than other teams? Did you feel that as an inside back?
I was one of the bigger backs as well, and suited to a certain style of play that was asked of me. You know, I was asked to take the ball up and gain yards, which may not have been to everyone's taste, but you know, if the coach is asking you to do that, that's what you're going to do. It's one of my strengths, and it was one of my strengths in playing. And we played at a time where, you know, it was a period where the Scottish team didn't score many tries. And that, as a player, was hugely frustrating as well. We had a good set of forwards, and we did have a good set of backs, but we just couldn't kind of connect the two together, and potentially the style that we were playing and the game plans that we had weren't really giving us the opportunity to play. Because you look at the guys, the way you have Sean Lamont, over 100 caps, you had your Chris Pashs, the Evans brothers, you know, I played in the centre, Nick DeLuca was in the centre, Simon Webster played in the centre, guys that could attack.
Yeah.
But we just weren't putting it all together. So I think when you say kind of forward oriented, our forwards were probably, you know, the strength of the team.
Yeah.
And the backs, we just didn't really capitalize. So it was frustrating, and frustrating to be part of a team that didn't score many tries, because over time now Scotland do score a lot of tries, and they've got exciting, really exciting players. But I think the difference was the playing pool and the group of players that there were to select from. We used to joke about it that it was harder to get out of the team than it was to get into the team,
right?
Because the coaches had their faithful guys, and there wasn't much in the way of depth.
Yeah.
Jar of backup players,
And
I'll hold my hand up and say I'll probably be included in that. But nowadays, you look at the Scotland team, and you know, we couldn't guess what the team was in the World Cup, what it was going to be from week to week, because you know the menu of players that the coaches had to select from was so much better. And that's been a huge thing that Scotland have done over the past few years, and that's to develop several guys in several different positions that can step up and play, where potentially, you know, during periods of my time, there wasn't that luxury.
Do you ever look at sort of maybe the Gregor Townsend team of, you know, when he first came into the role, you know, pretty open style of play, and think, you know, I would have enjoyed being part of that, where sort of, you know, playing outside Finn, for instance.
Yeah. I played with Finn a wee bit at Glasgow, and you know, he's just a maverick. He's been kind of branded that by many rugby people, but it's true. You kind of don't know what he's going to do, and as a result of that, defense is just haven't got a clue at times. So it's been great to watch him kind of pull the strings at times for Scotland. At times, the kind of lack of structure that he does play to can look a bit bad and shoot him in the foot, but
more often
than not, I think it's great to see, and it's what Scotland need. They need someone like that who can do that and let the rest of the world rugby set up and say they've got a good standoff there. So it would have been good to do, but I think, you know, it's across the team. That they're able to play that rugby, and you know, the back row of the Scots have at the moment a phenomenal couple of them being tipped to be in the Lions.
Yeah,
had a great season with Edinburgh, and and great World Cups, and people like Anders Boyd are really good. The front row, you know, guys like Fagerson, you know, Rory Sjoelund are, you know, again being picked to hit the line. Doing that platform that the backs have to attack off is huge. So I just think they've got a much more well-rounded team that links up and clicks together than I did at any time that I was playing.
So it'd be interesting to hear your take on the World Cup in 2011 and just that kind of overall experience and what your kind of main memories are from going down to New Zealand for that tournament.
Yeah, I'd become established in the Scotland team, and one thing I hadn't done was go to the World Cup. In 2007, I was part of the 38-man training squad, and I was one of the 8 players that didn't make it, which was hugely disappointing. Particularly as I felt that, you know, we'd kind of been told at the start of the preseason that if you really conducted yourself well and you, like, excelled in X, Y, and Z, you know, there's a good chance you'd be on that plane. And I made a real effort of, you know, properly focusing on being as good as I could have possibly been. And I was as strong as I could have been. I was as fit as I could have been. And we had leaderboards in the gym. And I managed to sort of find myself on most of the leaderboards for fitness and strength and all that stuff. And it was sort of a huge disappointment not to go. But, you know, everything happens for a reason. And, you know, knuckled down. And when Andy Robinson became coach of Scotland, I think I was one of his go-to guys. And would thankfully be, you know, one of the first names on a team sheet in his earlier days of coaching the national team.
Yeah.
So going to New Zealand, to me, this is going to be probably my last chance at a World Cup. So let's give it everything I've got. And I remember the week, I think it was a week or two before we went to the World Cup, we were still doing pre-season training, and there were rumours that the afternoon's fitness was going to be 50 100 metre back-to-backs on the pitch with
50.
And so we were like, there's just no way we could do that. And lo and behold, after lunch we all went out there and, right, boys, get on the line, you're going to do 50 100 metre sprints back-to-back in blocks of 10, not much rest. And
jeez,
through that, there's a couple of things. Yeah, it was an incredibly tough fitness session to do, but it also was a tool to help us pull each other through.
Yeah.
And to kind of work as a team to get through the pain, because you're going to have to do that on a game day. But unfortunately, like, what a session like that just wasn't great for me, and I got a stress fracture in my shin. And so the World Cup for me was incredibly painful, because I was on the physio slab for a couple of hours a day, just trying to get the swelling down, trying to get, you know, my leg not hurting through the sessions. But we were at a World Cup, and I was prepared to do everything I possibly could to play. But unfortunately, we had a tough old time. Like, I think the first game was against Romania, which we almost lost. In fact, we were losing for most of the game.
Then
we played against Georgia, which was very close. We were based in Invercargill, which, if you don't know, is kind of very southern town in New Zealand, and it's it's kind of based on Scotland, but it really is quite a backward town, and the facilities and hotels were very basic, and we played the first two games on this pitch, which, you know, was a bit of a quagmire, so there was just no opportunity to really start getting some fluid rugby going, whereas in our group you had Argentina, you had England based kind of elsewhere playing their games completely dry, roof on. To just start gaining some momentum. So when we went into, you know, playing Argentina, I'd say we were probably a little bit undercooked. And that's, you know, I don't want to sound like I'm blaming the environment and circumstance, but I guess that's how it felt. We'd never had a chance to really string some rugby together, because we were playing in, you know, pissing wet by rain on a quagmire. And so we kind of probably were a little bit undercooked, and it was disappointing because we didn't get out of the group. Tail between the legs. So for me, it was tough. It was hard mentally. It was physically painful. But, you know, you can never take away the fact that I was in New Zealand. The kind of religion is rugby there. Rugby is religion, and they just, I mean, it was a hugely welcoming country. impressive to be a part of that.
Yeah.
Every time we kind of went to another airport, there was hundreds of people there singing Flower Scotland, all the flags, kind of getting welcomed with a haka. It was emotional, and it was great to be part of. So I've got kind of mixed memories of it.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Like, I remember watching the match against your last match in the World Cup against Argentina, and I mean the game was almost there for the taking, but it felt as if like the team, you know, like started to put together some rugby towards the end of the match, and it was just like the kind of like, you know, fine margins between, you know, the team potentially going on to do something a bit, you know, pretty big in that tournament.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they scored a try with probably five or six missed tackles, which wasn't the reason we lost the game. I mean, going over the video review was incredibly painful because no one really played to their potential. Again,
right.
Pissing wet night, but we made a lot of errors and just didn't really click. Going through the video, seeing those glaring opportunities for us to kind of move the ball one way and we'd gone the other way. So just a lot of on-field poor decision-making by the players, myself included. But yeah, you know, I think you look at that and 99% of the people putting that down on paper before the game would say Argentina would beat Scotland.
Yeah, yeah.
And those were the games we lost because we were kind of meant to lose them. Mm. And what's, I guess, a bit positive now is that those games, Scotland will win.
Yeah.
Where it becomes a bit of an arm wrestle, Scotland will come out on top more often than they won't. And I guess as a Scottish person and for a player, that's hugely positive.
And what Scotland games do you sort of look back most fondly? What are your sort of favourite fixtures?
I mean, I played England three times. I won one, drew one, and lost one. So the Calcutta Cup victory that we had in 2009,
yeah,
8 or 9, was it was my kind of welcome back into the team after 4 years, and that was just brilliant for me. My dad had flown over from Hong Kong,
oh wow,
literally for the weekend. It was a pissing wet day at Murrayfield, which suited us to the team. You know, we kind of. We're of that era where we didn't really get the ball away. And just coming out on top of that game was brilliant, because no one expected it either. I just remember kind of going around. We were allowed out for a few beers that night. And
yeah.
Just walking into kind of even restaurants, bars, whatever, just the lift that victory gave Scotland was huge to kind of be part of.
Mm.
So that was a great one. I think probably my fondest memory of a game was when we played against Ireland in Croke Park in 2010.
Yeah, of course.
We had a very mediocre Six Nations. In fact, we'd lost the first four games, I think, or three games. We drew in the fourth, and we were going into like our final game with really kind of like nothing to lose, with no hope or expectation from anyone outside the group. To play against Ireland in Croke Park in the last ever rugby match in Croke Park, 87,000 people. I think they pretty much, you know, cemented themselves as the Triple Crown winners in their heads. And we just went out and played really well. And it was actually on YouTube not that long ago. They replayed the live game, and it was great to watch, and great memories to watch again. And Dan Parrish hitting that kick from the touchline with a couple of minutes to go. And when the final whistle went, I mean, huge elation. So that's got to be one of my favourite rugby memories. And, you know, not just in a Scotland jersey.
Yeah, that penalty kick was absolutely unbelievable. I think we like retweeted a photo or a video of the try that you set up for Johnny Beattie. And yeah, people were going absolutely mad for it. Just that unbelievable memory, you know.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, that finish from Beattie was kind of Lomu-esque. And I mean, if anyone scores that try, then that's a phenomenal effort. But it was just everything again seemed to go pretty well for us that day.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's a few questions that we try and ask all our guests. We'll just kind of rattle through, but kind of who in your career with Glasgow and Scotland was kind of your favourite player to play with, or maybe the best player that you played alongside?
ask this question and often get sort of chastised for my response. playing with Parksy, he was by no means everyone's favourite cup of tea, but he was just a really good, positive person to play with, really good team man. You take the rugby away from it, but just a phenomenally positive and good-natured person. Mm-hmm. Who never had a bad word to say about anyone, and was often the kind of the glue that kept the team together. And you know, if you talk about the rugby, yeah, okay, probably his style of play didn't suit everyone, but he won Scotland and Glasgow more games more or less single-handedly than anyone else I can recall.
Yeah, definitely.
On a wet night, you want him on the team sheet because he had the ability just to pin teams back. So I'd say him, but then I guess I played quite a lot of my career at Glasgow and Scotland with Max Evans in the centre, and we were very, very contrasting players. I spoke about my kind of strength being, you know, carrying the ball up, and that kind of was able to either whether through decoy running or, you know, multi-phase rugby, he was then able to sort of live off me that way. And I think we just had a very good chemistry together, both on and off the pitch. And so I had very good memories of playing with Max in the centre.
And what about the sort of the best or most impressive guy that you came up against? Maybe in general, and also, like, you know, on a man to man basis.
Yeah, I think my first few caps were against Australia, and Stirling Mortlock was at 13 at the time.
Yeah,
and my first few caps were 13. So playing against him was a huge learning curve for me, because he was world class. And then just watching the video replays the video analysis of the games, just watching him as a 13 and his work rate, particularly off the ball, the positions that he would get himself into by just absolutely working and working and working.
Right.
And then realising, you know, that was what I aspire to do, and it's not luck that he is sort of on the receiving end or making such good impact on the game. It's because he works like no one I've seen before. I played against Sonny Bill at Murrayfield, and it was his debut for the All Blacks, and he was the man of the match. and that was hugely impressive. I'd like to say it was a time where it doesn't really matter who your man is. That's what I'll cling on to. but I guess in a one-off game, one of the toughest opponents I'd have, and it comes as a surprise, is Ricky Flutie.
Really?
England.
At
Twickenham when we lost. I just could not keep up with him.
Really?
He had a great game. He has great footwork. He's a good link player. And yeah, I felt very, very mediocre playing against him that day. So I guess those three guys were up there.
We've got quite kind of.
You know, we're playing against Leinster. Sorry, a few times in the Darcy and Idris schools, playing them sort of twice a year and four times if we drew them in Europe. It was always a huge honour, but never hugely enjoyable because they were so good together. So yeah, them as well.
Nice one. Slightly more unusual question, but who's the best? Who's the best boozer that you've kind of socialised with off the pitch? Obviously,
The best boozer. Well, I grew up. I went to Dollar Academy. Went to Dollar and spent a lot of my time with John Barclay and became very close to him. Mm-hmm. That's not to say that he's by any stretch the best boozer, because he's actually pretty pathetic at boozing, but plenty of very good amusing nights out with him. Best boozer wise, I mean, I played in, again, the Scotland team, Jim Hamilton's, the Chunks, and Dan Parks was always up there. In fact, Parks, he was always probably the most entertaining, just because he's hilariously funny, and the next morning his recovery would always take a lot longer. I think his body didn't like to get rid of the alcohol before his time, so recovery sessions and swimming pools around the UK and further afield were quite entertaining when Parsi was there.
Oh, that sounds absolutely great. Graham, mate, thanks so much for your time. That's been absolutely brilliant. I think everyone's going to absolutely love listening to that, so just huge thanks for that.
Well, thanks. thanks for having me. It's been good to regale some old stories, and always good to talk about the game. So thanks for having me.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.